so long. I'm joining the page,
388,
the paragraph starting, but we have to carry still, or?
Yeah, that's where we are.
Okay. So yeah, it's 7:30, so there is the perhaps we can start, and I'll add others as they come online.
Sure. welcome everybody. We're resuming our study of chapter 3 in this part, book 2, part 1 of The Life Divine, The Eternal and the Individual. And as Shyam pointed out, I believe it's 388. Is it 388 or 368?
388.
Paragraph beginning, but we have to carry still further the conflict between the normal and the higher reason. And here, Sri Aurobindo thus far has been talking about this dichotomy between the individual and the cosmos. And so, what is the individual to the cosmos, and what is the cosmos to the individual? What is the individual ultimately is the primary question that he's asking. And he's starting from the standpoint that we take ourselves to be a finite ego, separate from other individuals, and that's how we experience ourselves. But at the same time, there is a mysterious kind of expansion of our sense of self which relates to the cosmos. So from that practical or empirical experience, he is connecting to what he has already projected as a transcendental possibility, which is that there is but one, only one, one reality alone. And so if there is this one reality alone, who are these many individuals? What are their relations to that one? And what are their relations to the cosmos, which seems to be a kind of range of possibilities within which these individuals operate? So this is what Sri Aurobindo posits, and then from there, in the paragraphs we have just covered, he's talking about, I think somebody has their computer on. I'm hearing a little echo. Do you hear that?
Maybe it's
just my laptop. Okay. Okay, if anybody has their speaker on, if you could mute it for the time being. So he's pointing out that this double experience, the experience on the one hand of a separative ego by which individuation seems to found itself as a process of survival in entities within the cosmos, is something that coexists with a sense of understanding the cosmos, of being in relation to the cosmos and with others, other individuals in the cosmos. And at the same time, an intuition of unity. So we have this spectrum of experience, on the one hand separated from others and from the universe and the cosmos, and the transcendent God, if you want to call him that. And on the other hand, an intuition of some profound sympathy and unity, an intimate relation and unity with other beings, cosmos, and with something which is absolute. So how does one reconcile these two? Is it possible to experience both these poles of the spectrum with clarity? This is one of the problems he's taking up over here. And I draw your attention to a few important sentences in what we've the last two paragraphs that we've considered. One is in this two paragraphs before, he says, the world being includes always the individual being. Therefore, these two becomings, the cosmic and the individual, are always related to each other and in their practical relation mutually dependent. But we find that the individual being also comes in the end to include the world in its consciousness. And since this is not by an abolition of the spiritual individual, but by his coming to his full, large and perfect self-consciousness, we must suppose that the individual always included the cosmos, and it is only the surface consciousness which by ignorance failed to possess that inclusion because of its self-limitation in ego. So this appearance of a separate existence, which is a empirical experience, a phenomenal experience as we find ourselves in the world, is something that becomes the foundation or starting point of a realization which eventually discovers that the universe or cosmos is within the individual, just as the individual is within the cosmos. So that is how we can intuit a double relation, a relation of immanence and of evolution in between the individual and the cosmos, in both cases mutually. So that leads him to say, but when we speak of the mutual inclusion of the cosmic and the individual, the world in me, I in the world, all in me, I in all, for that is the liberated self-experience, we are evidently traveling beyond the language of the normal reason. So here he's coming back to our major problem. What keeps us in this illusion of being a separate individual in a phenomenal cosmos? And it is the operation of the reason, taking the evidence of the senses of the physical existence as its basis. So it is the logical operation of the reason convincing us, based on the conviction of the senses, that we are a separate physical entity. Because after all, matter is that aspect of Brahman which makes possible this finite divisibility, complete division into finitude, into finiteness. So that becomes the operation of a certain self-identity going through the mind upon the senses or upon the evidence of the senses. This is because the words, as he says over here, this is because the words we have to use were minted by mind and given their values by an intellect bound to the conceptions of physical space and circumstance, and using for the language of a higher psychological experience figures drawn from the physical life and the experience of the senses. So this is the foundation of our problem. So a little later he will say this sentence, which is very provocative and stimulating. But the plane of consciousness to which the liberated human being arises is not dependent upon the physical world, and the cosmos which we thus include and are included in is not the physical cosmos, but the harmonically manifest being of God in certain great rhythms of his conscious force and self-delight. So here it's a kind of a complex sentence. Every now and then Sri Aurobindo will expand into a complex sentence like this. But we can consider this from a certain point of view as a self-experience of the only one, of the only one there is, Brahman. So that self-experience is, because of the radical infinity of Brahman, it is one of many self-experiences or a set of experiences among infinite possible experiences in which this infinite being presents itself to itself as a ordered range of consciousness. This is what he calls the harmonically manifest being of God in certain great rhythms of his conscious force and self-delight. So in this self-appearance or self-presentation to itself as cosmos, as something which is a coherent, harmonious range of consciousness, of conscious being, it enters into individuality. Each of these ranges of consciousness have beings, and these beings are, in a sense, individuals. And we may have individuals that are archetypal, that don't change, and we may have individuals that are evolutionary, that in fact struggle to become an individual. And after gaining a certain foothold of individuality, persist as individuals, though the physical reality subjects this individuality to a repeated birth and death. So this persistence of the individual in different forms within this cosmic self-appearance is also a manifestation of the same absolute being. There is only one. That one is manifest to itself as the cosmos, which is a arrangement of itself, and as the entities that inhabit the cosmos, which is a self-manifestation of variations of the possibilities that exist within that cosmos. So individuations make the infinite possibilities of variation in the cosmos available for mutual relation. These are put into relation with each other, with the totality of the cosmos in which these individuals or entities exist, and with the one alone that has become all these things. We can see now from this viewpoint that this kind of self-appearance that Sri Aurobindo is positing of the one is maintained by the need for relation. Or not really the need, because it has no need, but because of its radical infinity, maintains itself in every form that it can maintain itself. And this is one of those forms, the form of cosmos and individual in relation with each other and with the one being there is. So this is how he ends. This means that cosmos and individual are manifestations of a transcendent self, who is indivisible being, although he seems to be divided or distributed. But he is not really divided or distributed, but indivisibly present everywhere. Therefore all is in each, and each is in all, and all is in God, and God is in all. God in all. And when the liberated soul comes into union with this transcendent, it has this self-experience of itself and cosmos, which is translated psychologically into a mutual inclusion and a persistent existence of both in a divine union, which is at once a oneness and a fusion and an embrace. So this is a very, very powerful key. key sentence in which Sri Aurobindo is giving us the central meaning of this relational cosmos. Why does Brahman enter into this kind of a manifestation, self-manifestation? It enters into this kind of a self-manifestation because it multiplies itself relationally. And through this relational self-multiplication, it knows itself and enjoys itself in a triple form in infinite beings. And this triple form is what he is pointing out here. A oneness, a fusion, and an embrace. These three ways of experience, which are simultaneous, pertain to the three kinds of philosophies, which are Advaita, Vishishtadvaita, and Dvaita, or they pertain to the three simultaneous realities of the supermind, which is transcendence, universality, and individuality. So the oneness is the absolute undivided being and its identity in all things. So to know oneself as a self-appearance of Brahman, I am that, that is the oneness. Yet it is also a fusion because that implies the infinity of the one.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, who is that? Hello, who is that? Somebody asked to be...
That was Joanna Navarro.
Okay. Joanna, we can hear you. If you can keep your mic off, we can hear you.
I just heard you now. When I asked, I hadn't heard anything before at all.
Okay.
So now I hear you.
Okay. So the fusion that he's talking about over here is the recognition of the infinity of God and the knowledge of the unity of the One in all its manies. It's all and its many. The all... As he says, there are two kinds of multiplicity of the divine. One kind of multiplicity is cosmos, the sense of the all inclusive. The other kind of multiplicity is the sense of the many individuals. So it is the fusion recognizes the coexistence of the one with the many and enters or experiences identity with all these many. That is the fusion that is related to the polarity of what one might call Vishishtadvaita, qualified non-dualism. And the third is the embrace, which deliberately experiences its separation as the foundation of relationship, that experiences or delights in duality so that the one may know itself as the delight of union, of what he calls here the embrace implies multiplicity in relation as discrete individualities. So this is the gist of it. The gist of it is the play of delight. The play of delight working through relation but maintaining a self-presentation in forms of a cosmos and of multiple individuals that individualize the variations of the cosmos, which is itself a self-presentation of a harmonious arrangement or configuration of infinity. The last paragraph that we did then again returns to the problem of the mind, which cannot grasp this complexity, grasp this dimensional, higher dimensional topology, if we may call it that. So here it's again he points out that this is a problem which comes because of the mind trying to grapple with the finite and the infinite at the same time. So he says, I quote here, he's talking about the mutuality of the true being, the true self, the true person that knows itself to be the one and yet can experience infinite self-presentations of the one, and in that relationship knows the one's self-mutuality. And there's a very powerful way in which Sri Aurobindo talks about this as a one and a more than one. Certain modern philosophers have also talked about it in these terms, as the absolute being more than one, as one and yet more than one. So we'll get to that in a moment. But he says, this mutuality founded in unity is the whole secret of the divine existence in its perfect manifestation. It must be the basis of anything to which we can give the name of a divine life. So this sentence is one of those really powerful sentences that encapsulates the whole of Sri Aurobindo's view or teaching. It's another way of saying what he says in the Synthesis of Yoga when he makes the statement, the realization of oneness and the practice of oneness in difference is the whole of the yoga. This is another way of saying the very same thing. This mutuality founded in unity is the whole secret of the divine existence in its perfect manifestation. It must be the basis of anything to which we can give the name of a divine life. And then he comes to the problem. But secondly, we see that the whole difficulty and confusion into which the normal reason falls is that we are speaking of a higher and illimitable self-experience founded on divine infinities, and yet are applying to it a language formed by this lower and limited experience, which founds itself on finite appearances and the separative definitions by which we try to distinguish and classify the phenomena of the material universe. In other words, he's repeating what he had said in the previous paragraph. It's the mind applying itself to the finite experience of the body through the senses. See, that gives this problem. So those are some of the key points that he has made. And then he tries to resolve that problem. And this is the problem of the reason, as he's pointing out. And reading towards the end. Thus, when we speak of an individual, we mean ordinarily an individualization of mental, vital, physical being, separate from all other beings, incapable of unity with them by its very individuality. So here he's talking about the prakritic complex, which we take ourselves to be. We take ourselves to be an individualized qualitative being, or a qualitative subjectivity / objectivity with a distinct mind, vital and physical. And that cannot unite itself or know itself to be the same as another. Well, actually, it can to some extent. And that's the whole thing about even the prakriti existing within a cosmos of which it is a part and which is a part of it. So that the mind can know its own operations as just specific operations of the universal mind. The vital can know its operations, specific operations of the universal vital. And the physical is just another variation of the universal physical. And yet, there is a sense of individuality that persists within this universality. It is not to be found in the mental, vital, physical complex, but deeper within, in what we might call a soul. So then he goes to that. And he says, It is therefore necessary, okay, if we go beyond these three, so capable of unity, capable at most of a spiritual contact and soul sympathy. It is therefore necessary to insist that by the true individual, we mean nothing of the kind, but a conscious power of being of the eternal, always existing by unity. If we go beyond these three terms, so in other words, we go beyond the prakritic complex of mind, life and body and speak of the soul or individual self, we still think of an individualized being separate from all others, incapable of unity and inclusive mutuality, capable at most of a spiritual contact and soul sympathy. So this is the notion of a individualized soul. And that has its own truth. Each soul is unique. It is a unique spark of the divine. In other words, the entirety of the divine has narrowed itself to a certain kind of self-presentation in which a limited self presentation, a limited perspective on self, is taken as the starting point and the configuration through which an evolution can occur. See, so that's the reason why it seems as if the soul is also distinct and cannot really be one with others. But he's pointing out that that's not the case, both because the soul contains the cosmos in itself and is not only meant to realize that in a cosmic consciousness experience, but also meant to manifest that in the evolution of the soul into a universality. The soul evolves in two ways. One is the evolution of the soul into the master of nature, and the other is the Ishvara, and the other is the evolution of the soul from its knowledge of itself as an individual, separated from others, to its knowledge of itself as an individual that is completely universal, that contains all the universe within itself. So this is the culmination of the soul's own trajectory. And as he says, it is therefore necessary to insist that by the true individual, we mean nothing of the kind, but a conscious power of being of the eternal, always existing by unity, always capable of mutuality. A conscious power of being of the eternal. In other words, the Shakti of the eternal, the power of the eternal, which has all the powers of the eternal within itself, and which can deploy each one of these powers, infinite powers, as a kind of self-presentation. So this is the Shakti whose self-becoming we are. Para Prakritir Jiva Bhuta is the phrase that he will use in a number of places, quoting from the Gita. But as he also is going to point out in the next paragraph, it is not only a power of the being of the eternal, which is the self-manifestation of the supreme Shakti, but also the being itself, because there is nothing other than the being. As a power of manifestation of the eternal, the individual can know itself as the entire cosmos and know that the cosmos resides in the individual. But as the being itself, it knows that each individual is transcendent, that it transcends the cosmos, that every individual is not only bound by the harmony or the harmonics of the self-configuration of the divine in the cosmos, but can break and change and transform that particular configuration. So I think that is where we are right now. I read the last line. It is that being which by self-knowledge enjoys liberation and immortality. And he is referring in that line to the lines from the Isha Upanishad that talk about the enjoyment of liberation and immortality. So we can begin, if unless somebody has a comment, question at this point.
We can't really hear you.
Sorry. My mic was muted. Yeah. So, what exactly is the individuality when he is describing it as a conscious power of being of the eternal? Is this like a conscious power with a particular style sheet? Or does that exist beyond time?
So, okay, can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. That's a good question. A conscious power with a style sheet would mean a limited matrix of possibilities. But it is also, and how does it relate to, how does it go beyond the time? Why is it a conscious power of the eternal? It is a conscious power of the eternal because it is infinite. But it is also an infinite which enters time as a certain configuration. That style sheet that you're talking about is a kind of expandable style sheet. It is something which presents itself in time, but appears out of infinity, and it is the infinite and the eternal appearing in time as a expandable set. And that expandable set is also not really expandable because it is learning something, but because the eternal and the infinite is its essence, and out of that essence it is deploying itself and evolving into universality, evolving into the totality, and yet maintaining a certain kind of configuration. In other words, when you're talking about a style sheet is just a matrix, but also within that matrix there may be a certain type of a formation which attracts other types of entities or other types of styles, if you want to call it that, which has a certain kind of individuality in that sense. So there is, the cosmos itself is a being like that, a kind of individualization itself, which follows a certain kind of configuration of that infinite style sheet. And that configuration is peculiar to this cosmos because it is an ordered cosmos. All cosmoses are not ordered in a kind of graded set of consciousness. There may be other ordering principles to other cosmoses, but this graded kind of harmony of consciousness is the characteristic of the individual that we may call the cosmic being. Similarly, each individual has got its own kind of peculiarity of ordering, which then is evolving through time. But ultimately, behind that evolution, the infinite and the eternal is entering into time as a certain possibility of this evolution. Does that make sense?
In computer language, if I put it, can you call it like it's a potential of like child processes which can be spawned as soon as the time opens?
Yeah, in a way you may say that, except that we have to realize that time also is eternal or perpetual. There is no beginning to time and there is no end to time. But yes, time begins. In fact, you may define the beginning of time as the evolutionary beginning. In other words, there is a what you're calling a child process, a kind of self-presentation which forms the start of a certain process. And whole notion of eternal beginnings and endings, the births and deaths of the cosmos, which we talk about as yugas and manvantaras, can be thought of like that. The configuration is also evolving. It is as if that's where Sri Aurobindo at one place in the record of yoga says that the entire kind of individuality starting from scratch and ending with a complete end of a pralaya yet returns not from scratch but at a higher stage of the beginning of the individual. So it's as if the qualitative beginning points are constantly changing from point zero of time in any particular kind of time that we may want to define, because ultimately there is no point zero of time. So time as a dimension of eternity is always present, and yet it is its own dimension. So beings who belong to that dimension experience it in a certain way.
So, I mean, the time part, honestly, I'm not really sure. I mean, are you trying to say, I understand that individuality is always potentially there, which is one of the aspects of the unknowable, meaning it can never be fully known. Because it has always infinite potential. And other than the time part, the other part is, that, you know, it has, an evolutionary intelligence, which is different from algorithmic intelligence, meaning it's not like a predefined function, but, it can evolve with an infinite possibility again. I mean, meaning infinity nested in infinity, in other words.
Yes. Yes, that. Anything else? Yeah, I completely agree with that. The other part which you're talking about with regard to time is like saying, if you were to say that this, what we just discussed, what you just said, this, or if you call it child processes, this self-individualization of the absolute, of the only one there is a kind of eternal self-presence. In other words, the one is present to itself not only as the one but as the many. It is always present to itself as the many, and also always present to itself as all the possibilities of these many individually unfolding in a certain dimension of itself that we can call time. In the experience of time, time itself is a finiteness. It is a discretion, just as body or matter is a finiteness and a discretion. So space, time and matter are the three forms of discretion of the infinite being, by which it plays this trick of experiencing three forms of delight of relation.
Thank you.
So there was just the in that last line, which is where he says, "But a conscious power of being of the eternal." So then, when we start redefining the individual in such a way, then what does he really mean by the word conscious power there? I mean, what is the difference between like a conscious power and say, simply an attribute of the eternal? It goes down to like when we start redefining words like individual, then why should we let alone words like the power, right? Like, what does it mean?
It's important to recognize that. Conscious power, that I tried to point to that, the conscious power of being of the eternal is a reference to the Shakti. It is a reference to the Chit Shakti, the Chit aspect of the Satchidananda. In other words, that which is deploying in the matrix of infinity into a manifestation. So it is self-becoming. Conscious power of the eternal means the power of self-becoming. So this self-becoming of the infinite in various seeming finites is a power of the eternal. So it's by its own power that it is doing that. And each one of these entities is a manifestation of that power. And hence it is nothing other than that power of the eternal. This is another way of saying that we are formations of the Chit Shakti. This is why I mentioned that Sri Aurobindo uses two terms which he gets from the Gita, and those are the two terms he's going to pull out. Here he doesn't mention it, but in a number of other places he does. This sentence goes back to the Gita, to one of Sri Aurobindo's favorite phrases, para prakritir jiva bhuta. In other words, the self, the individual becoming, jiva bhuta, to become individual, the individual becoming of the supreme prakriti, of the power of the eternal, in other words. So that is one aspect of defining the individual. But that doesn't end it. There is a second aspect. It is not only a power of becoming of the eternal, but it is the eternal itself. So he says that the other term is there's another phrase in the Gita where he says that nitya amsa, amsa sanatana, the perennial part or portion of myself. You are nothing but when he says portion, there is no real portion. The totality of the infinite being, of the Purushottama, is present in each soul. It seems to be a portion because it is subjecting itself to the experience of time. And in time, it experiences itself as a growth, as a way by which it hides certain possibilities which are latent in it and deploys them through relation in time. So this sentence, and going back to your question, Shyam, is related to the prakriti, the supreme prakriti, para prakriti jiva bhuta, the individual becoming of the supreme shakti or supreme prakriti, which is the power of the eternal. And we are aspects where we are, in other words, we are the power of the eternal, the divine mother, who has manifest all her possibilities in the cosmos and as the cosmos.
Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah.
To pursue this a little bit further, I'm trying to understand this meaning of individuality also. Can we go back to these powers of the Brahman that we talked about? I think it was in the previous chapter, of variability and of self-immersion in any one of self-selection, self-immersion, any one of these aspects of variation, so that the individual is a power of self-limitation or self-presentation, And it's individual because it's a selection from the infinite of possibilities in its presentation, but it's eternal and infinite because even though it's a presentation and a selection or specific selection, its essence is the essence, the only essence there is, which is the one.
Yes, yes, exactly. So because as you're saying, if we go back to that, where he's talking about variation and limit, self-limitation and self-absorption, these are the three powers that he talks about, the Shakti. In other words, Chit Shakti has three powers by which it acts, and these are the three. This self-variation, this gives rise firstly to the cosmos, the self-variation. What ways in which I can deploy my energies? These energies can be configured in a certain way and put into relation in a certain way. This kind of cosmos in which we exist is a certain such variation, a spectrum of the powers of the eternal, as a infinite sort of gradation of consciousness. Then we have the entities within them, which are selections. So if we take selections and self-limitation in each of these selections within these variations, then we find entities. And then the self-absorption is the totality has actually entered into. So as he says, in self-absorption, what is happening is that what is not being concentrated on is kept behind. So if we can think of the divine concentrating on itself multiply at the same time with infinite points of self-concentration on its own infinity, then that concentration intensifies to a point where it becomes material. And that materiality is the ultimate, you know, sort of condition for the existence of finiteness. So the experience of finiteness is possible there. And that experience of finiteness is contextualized in time and space, which are finitizing instruments, ontological instruments, you may say, for the self-concentration of the subject. And that, you know, that infinite process is what creates a kind of the cosmos of beings that are maintained in time, in space locally, and in time evolutionarily in relation with one another. See, that is how the whole play is occurring through these operations of the Brahman that you talked about just now.
And so the individuality is behind its oneness. There's only one. There's only one individual.
Exactly.
But in front,
yeah,
in front, it's the particular stage in an evolutionary universe of development or of a structure that any one of these variations is at any given time and space, and that individuality is a self-selection from all of this, from the infinitude of possibilities.
Exactly. And then that is in evolution, so that is moving towards its own self-experience as the entire cosmos, which is the particular configuration of the selection within which each individual is again selected and absorbed in, and also as the only being there is. So that is the entire trajectory of the, you know, self-concentration or the tapas of Ishvara, guiding the totality of the becoming. That tapas itself is the Shakti. The tapas of Ishvara is Shakti, the Shakti has become this cosmos. So the cosmos is the self-becoming of the Shakti as the tapas of Ishvara, and within it, it has multiplied itself as forms of concentration, forms of tapas, in each possibility or each entity, which is thus also in the becoming of the cosmos. The self-becoming of the cosmos is the self-becoming of all the entities in the cosmos, and the two are in dynamic relationship. And both these two forms of infinity, the two forms of the many, as he calls it, the all and the each, are both self-becomings of the tapas of Ishvara, which is nothing other than the Shakti or the Divine Mother.
Thank you, Debashish.
So we, when I was asking about this individuality, does it exist beyond time? So, as I recall, you were referring to no. I mean, it does exist beyond time. So, if the selection has to do with the individuality or the variation, whichever you call it, so that selection is a process which indicates that it is happening in time, right?
Yeah, process happens in time. But that time is also a kind of a dimension of the self-experience of the timeless. So, the timeless being, Purushottama, there is only one individual that is also an infinite individual. So, every possibility of individuality exists in it. It can experience all these possibilities at once, or it can experience them as progressive developments. And this idea of experiencing its infinite possibilities of individuation as self-developments is what we can call time. We could say that this idea is the real idea of time.
Are we ready to read the next paragraph? Margaret, would you like to read next?
Yes. But we have to carry still farther the conflict between the normal and the higher reason. When we speak of the true individual as a conscious power of being of the eternal, we are still using intellectual terms. We cannot help it. Unless we plunge into a language of pure symbols and mystic values of speech. But what is worse, we are, in the attempt to get away from the idea of the ego, using a too abstract language. Let us say, then, a conscious being who is for our valuations of existence a being of the eternal in his power of individualizing self-experience. For it must be a concrete being and not an abstract power who enjoys immortality. And then we get to this, that not only am I in the world and the world in me, but God is in me and I am in God. by which yet it is not meant that God depends for his existence on man, but that he manifests himself in that which he manifests within himself. The individual exists in the transcendent, but not all the transcendent is there concealed in the individual. Further, I am one with God in my being, and yet I can have relations with him in my experience. I, the liberated individual, can enjoy the divine in his transcendence, unified with him, and enjoy at the same time the divine in other individuals and in his cosmic being. Evidently, we have arrived at certain primary relations of the Absolute, and they can only be intelligible to the mind if we see that the transcendent, the individual, the cosmic being are the eternal powers of consciousness. We fall again, this time without remedy, into a wholly abstract language of an absolute existence, a unity yet more than a unity, which so expresses itself to its own consciousness in us, but which we cannot adequately speak of in human language and must not hope to describe either by negative or positive terms to our reason, but can only hope to indicate it to the utmost power of language.
So before we begin, I'm wondering about a certain sentence there. If you have the same as I have, because this is the sentence which goes, the individual exists in the transcendent, but all the transcendent is there concealed in the individual. What is the, because I think Margaret read, the individual exists in the transcendent, but not all the transcendent is there concealed in the individual.
Yeah, I don't have that not. I mean, we mean, which means then in the PDF that not is not there.
Mine was in error.
Okay, good, okay. Oh. Yeah, because that's a very, very,
yes,
very key.
Yes, I thought back and I thought, did I say not? Yeah, thank you for the correction.
Okay, good. So, as he's saying over here, that philosophically we land into all kinds of problems. And this was exactly one of the points that we discussed just some time back about when we say power of the eternal, do we mean just some kind of quality or some kind of attribute? Are we talking about a style sheet, things of that nature? Which, yes, if we talk about power of the eternal, it would seem that that's what's being referred to. But as we say, as I try to say, the power of the eternal, the power of the being of the eternal that he's talking about, that power of the being of the eternal is none other than the being of the eternal. And this is just in a certain operation, the operation of becoming. So power deployed is the becoming of being. And that's the reason why these look like attributes and things like that, which indeed is the case. But at the same time, it is the self-becoming of the being itself. The tapas of Ishvara is no other than Ishvara itself. The entirety of Ishvara enters into its infinite tapas. So this is the way in which the Shakti and the Ishvara are both always present in each individual. This is a very, very profound point, and it also relates to the fact that not often mentioned, that what we call the psychic being is not merely a Purusha, but also a Prakriti. It is the first beginning of actual integrality, the integral Purusha Prakriti pair, not separated, but in essence, the totality of the supramental Purusha Prakriti, Ishvara Shakti, present in each individual. So the Prakritic part of the psychic being is what we may call the power of being of the eternal. While and that is what actually inhabits or relates to the Prakritic instruments that nature provides the jiva in its evolution. But at the same time, each jiva is nothing but the eternal himself. And so that's why he's saying that it is a conscious being, that each individual is not merely a conscious power of being of the eternal, which seems to be an abstract thing. In other words, something like an attribute or a style sheet or whatever you want to call it. But as he says there, the conscious being who for our values of existence, a being of the eternal in his power of individualizing self-experience. This is what I meant by the tapas of Ishvara is Ishvara itself as tapas. The being itself is present. It's a kind of in a very simplistic way. I am reminded of something that one of the ashramites, Dr. Maheshwari, once told me, which exemplified this rather abstruse discussion in a very simple way to me, which is that when two people shake hands, we may say that they are shaking hands, but their experience is not really one of shaking a morphological part of one being, but of contacting another person. And so this is exactly where the so-called attribute and the power of the being is actually nothing other than the being. The being is fully present in its power because there is nothing other than the being. The becoming is the becoming of being. So this is the point that he's making, and this, as I said, relates to the other statement in the Gita, mam amsa sanatana, my eternal portion. Each individual is nothing but my eternal portion. And the word portion is only being used in a kind of temporal sense. Each individual, as he says later, he makes that clear. Why is it mam amsa sanatana? Because God does not depend on his self-limitations. God does not depend for his existence on man, but he manifests in himself in that which he manifests within himself. Within himself are all the possibilities of his being. In other words, immanent to the divine is every possibility, radical infinity. That is what he manifests within himself. And what is every selection, such as our cosmos, is a manifestation within the body of God, as one might say. And in it, what he manifests is himself, although one and only is present in each of its properties and attributes, and each combination of its properties and attributes. Present not only in kind of as an index, as something which is upholding that, but fully present in it, present as the being itself, as that attribute. See? So he says that very key sentence that I was pointing to, that the individual exists in the transcendent, but all the transcendent is there concealed in the individual. So that is the key. And from the viewpoint of time, this is the self-experience as development of that transcendent. But from the viewpoint of the timeless, the entire possibility of self, eternal self-deployment is paradoxically self-manifest always. See? So that is always going to be a paradox for us because we are contained within the domain or dimension of time. It's only by bridging the timeless and the world of time that we can arrive at an understanding. And that is exactly why the supermind is of a different order of existence than the ignorance creation with the mind at its summit. Further, I am one with God in my being, and yet I can have relations with Him in my experience. So this is what the special kind of self-manifestation, of individuation, and of temporary or temporal, located and temporal existence offers us. It offers us the delight of relation. It offers us the delight of multiple relation, of relation with the Absolute, of relation with the cosmos, with relation with other individuals. All of these as nothing other than self-appearances of the Absolute. Those are the primary relations of the Absolute that, as he says, we have arrived at. They can be intelligible to the mind if we see that the transcendent, the individual, the cosmic being are the eternal powers of consciousness. And again, he's saying, as soon as we say that, we are falling into that same problematic abstract language. As soon as we say powers of consciousness, it seems to be other than being. But it is nothing but the powers of consciousness of an absolute existence, a unity, yet more than a unity. This is the point I was making. A unity, yet more than a unity. This is the most profound meditation that one can conduct on the reality of the divine who has manifested himself and remains yet nothing but the divine in itself and in all its manifestations. Which so expresses itself to its consciousness in us, but which we cannot adequately speak of in human language and must not hope to describe either by negative or positive terms to our reason, but can only hope to indicate it to the utmost power of our language. Language fails here. This is the reason why profound statements like this at a certain point lead us into the meditation that can bring experience, to bring the experience that is beyond words, or beyond at least the words of human beings.
Actually, this paragraph was really something that probably clarified certain things. So one thing I was thinking of, if you could shed some light on that, it was reminding me of that Isha Upanishad, that Sloka 8, where it talks about that four things, Sayamvu, Kavi, Manishi, and Padivu, there he mentions that the fact that it becomes is the idea. So that I was thinking whether this individuality could also be thought of as that Godhead concealed in the transcendent, which, you know, one fine moment or not exactly in time like our time, but, you know, it raises its head and chooses to become, and thereby the individual exists. So that is the idea that it chose to become. That in time, that is actually the deployment, which is the Padivu. And before that, it can design its whole experience. So basically, and also just to mention that style sheet is not really maybe it is not, it's just a wrong word to use. It's not just an attribute of an outward character, but it's more like the layout of the experience, or the design of the experience, or the thread of experience that it chooses. Anyway, so that paribu and the pack, I mean the pack that it becomes is the idea, chooses to become. Could you please comment on that a little bit?
Yeah. Also, actually, I wanted to say that yes, I completely agree with you about also about the style sheet idea and the attribute idea. The attribute or the body of attributes, or the combination of attributes. There is a style sheet and there is a body of attributes, and that is the power of the divine in becoming. But at the same time, it is also the being. And I don't think, I think you, that's what you meant. I understood that that's what you meant. That the so-called style sheet is just a kind of a configuration of self-becoming. So, yes, and that is paribhu. You're quite right. Now, think about this, the Kavi Manishi Swayambhu paribhu, the one who becomes everywhere, but becomes so by self-seeing, kavi, to see oneself and then to concentrate on what is seen is what is the manishi. The manishi is the tapas, the form by which that which is seen becomes. So very true, and that is because time is a dimension of the timeless. From the viewpoint of time, it is definitely such a process which whose beginning always eludes us. Because these beginning, there is a very beautiful place where Sri Aurobindo says, there are events which occur or which belong to the timeless. An event of the timeless, an event in the timeless is very different from an event in time. This is an event of the timeless. So from that point of view, and as you said, it's a different kind of beginning, a different kind of experience of time than our experience of time. Very true. That is exactly what it is.
Devashish, going back to your statement about the psychic being, you said that it was a prakritic instrument of the jiva in its evolution. My question is, when Sri Aurobindo went to find a Sanskrit word for the psychic being, he chose Chaitya Purusha, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Is it a limitation of language that there isn't a prakriti word then in the definition of the psychic being? I mean, we know that it is because it's an evolutionary instrument, but he did use the word purusha as part of its definition. Just I thought maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, it's actually very, very profound and very difficult. I also, for a long time, believe that when we are talking about the psychic being, we are talking about this sort of essence of the Purusha. And I agree that, and I still hold to that belief, or still hold to that understanding. But I also started wondering that the Purusha is a Purusha of qualities. It's not merely a kind of a witness, as one talks about the mental Purusha. When one says the mental Purusha is just a witness, Sankhya makes the Purusha into a pure witness. But that is not the way in which the Gita talks about the Purushottama, the Supreme Person. And then that Supreme Person is becoming each individual, and hence every Purusha as a Chaitya Purusha is the totality of the Supreme Person, and that person's infinite qualities exist in each of these persons that we are. Now, what is also interesting, actually I have to back up and say, what clinched or confirmed this view of the union of Purusha and Prakriti for me was a conversation I had with Kirit Joshi, who had, I feel, one of the profoundest understandings of Sri Aurobindo's yoga, and who had been in dialogue with the mother on these very profound things, one of the few people who did. And he expressed in uncategorical terms that the psychic being is a union of the Purusha and the Prakriti. And when we think about Chaitya Purusha as a term, the word Chaitya means that having consciousness, having Chit, Chaitya, or deriving from Chit, coming from Chit, Chaitya, the Purusha who comes from consciousness, or who is who belongs to consciousness, we may say. You see, in a way, that particular understanding of Chaitya Purusha equates with this profound mantric statement that you just read, in fact, or in that particular paragraph, see, where he says, that part where he says, he manifests himself in that which he manifests within himself. He manifests himself in that which he manifests within himself. What is it that he manifests within himself? He manifests what he sees as his possibilities, as his infinite possibilities. And that self-manifestation is the self-manifestation of consciousness, because it is self-consciousness, to be conscious of oneself, that causes manifestation to occur. Therefore, that is Chit, and yet he inhabits his self-manifestation. And hence, it is Purusha that is the self-manifest within his self-manifestation. I believe that is what is meant by the word Chaitya Purusha. The Purusha born in consciousness. The Purusha that is of consciousness.
Thank you so much.
Hence, the Purusha born of Prakriti, the son born of the mother. See, this is the reason why the psychic being is nothing but a child of the mother. Literally, that's what it means. Oh.
Thank you, Devashish.
Just one second, one little point I wanted to make just before Joanna reads. This last part where he's talking about a unity, yet more than a unity, which so expresses itself to its own consciousness in us, but which we cannot adequately speak of in human language, and must not hope to describe either by negative or positive terms to our reason, but can only hope to indicate it to the utmost power of our language. And here we come to this point of the self-manifestation, which by very dint of self-limitation is falsifying itself. So, how is it going to maintain its infinity at any point of its own self-manifestation? We have to see that it does so by self-contradiction. always whatever can be said, its opposite can also be said. And these are the positive and negative terms. The positive and negative terms, neither of which can adequately describe this reality. So if you express it in positive terms, what you've expressed has already limited its infinity. Hence, you have to wipe it clean, erase it through the negative terms. And yet these negative terms are then going to make possible an even greater positive description, and so on and so forth, which in another way is the very basis of the foundation of manifestation, and again, of the discretization of the experience of a manifestation as something which exists in time, and therefore is a
Okay, then I guess I'll start to read. But the normal mind, which has no experience of these things that are so powerfully real to the liberated consciousness, may well revolt against what may seem to it nothing more than a mass of intellectual contradictions. It may say, I know very well what the Absolute is. It is that in which there are no relations. The absolute and the relative are irreconcilable opposites. In the relative, there is nowhere anything absolute. In the absolute, there can be nothing relative. Anything which contradicts these first data of my thought is intellectually false and practically impossible. These other statements also contradict my law of contradictions, which is that two opposing and conflicting affirmations cannot both be true. It is impossible that there should be oneness with God, and yet a relation with Him such as this of the enjoyment of the divine. In oneness, there is no one to enjoy except the one, and nothing to be enjoyed except the one. God, the individual, and the cosmos must be three different actualities. Otherwise, there could be no relations between them. Either they are eternally different, or they are different in present time, although they may have originally been one undifferentiated existence and may eventually re-become one undifferentiated existence. Unity was perhaps and will be perhaps, but it is not now and cannot be so long as cosmos and the individual endure. The cosmic being can only know and possess the transcendent unity by ceasing to be cosmic. The individual can only know and possess the cosmic or the transcendent unity by ceasing from all individuality and individualization. Or if unity is the one eternal fact, then cosmos and individual are non-existent. They are illusions imposed on itself by the eternal. That may well involve a contradiction or an unreconciled...
You could think of it like this.
Is somebody...
You think of it is that...
Somebody's doctor is not on mute. Okay, I'm going to go back. Or if unity is one eternal fact, then cosmos and individual are non-existent. They are illusions imposed on itself by the eternal. That may well involve a contradiction or an unreconciled paradox, but I am willing to admit a contradiction in the eternal, which I am not compelled to think out, rather than a contradiction here of my primary conceptions, which I am compelled to think out logically and to practical ends. I am on this supposition able either to take the world as practically real and think and act in it, or to reject it as an unreality and cease to think and act. I am not compelled to reconcile contradictions, not called on to be conscious of and conscious in something beyond myself and world, and yet deal from that basis, as God does, with a world of contradictions. the attempt to be as God while I am still an individual, or to be three things at a time, seems to me to involve a logical confusion and a practical impossibility. Such might well be the attitude of the normal reason, and it is clear, lucid, positive in its distinctions. It involves no extraordinary gymnastics of the reason trying to exceed itself and losing itself in shadows and half-lights or any kind of mysticism. Or at least there is only one original and comparatively simple mysticism, free from all other difficult complexities. Therefore, it is the reasoning which is the most satisfactory to the simply rational mind. Yet, is there here a triple error, the error of making an unbridgeable gulf between the absolute and the relative, the error of making too simple and rigid and extending too far the law of contradictions, and the error of conceiving in terms of time, the genesis of things which have their origin and first habitat in the eternal. I think that's a very funny paragraph.
Yes, so this paragraph, in this paragraph, Sri Aurobindo drives home the practical logic of the rational mind. And it's quite interesting that he actually puts it, the whole thing, in quotation marks, because this is one of the few places where he does that. He personalizes this kind of mind. So it becomes easy to see what he's saying. In many other cases, he often does the same thing without actually putting it in inverted quotes. And it often confuses people because they think that that's his reasoning, until they read sufficiently and finds that he kind of subverts that reasoning. But here he's pointing to this practical reason, working on the basis of the phenomenal experience. And there, as he says, that one can find that there are three different things. If we admit of a God, or of an absolute, of some transcendent, or of some one being, one, then we have to say that that is a certain reality that is not the same as our reality, at least as we experience it. And the second is that there is a cosmos, and if we say that there is a cosmic being or an entire cosmos that interacts in a way or with the individual and with which the individual is in relation, then that is a separate thing. We experience it all the time as something that we are in relation with, much more than we experience God or the Absolute for that matter. And then there is the individual and other individuals. So he's saying that from our phenomenal experience, it would appear that these are three eternal separate terms. It's almost, when we talk about a radical dualism, this is a radical triplicity or trinity, a radically separate trinity, you know. So then he says, or this could be a case of a differentiation of the one. In other words, somehow there was only one, the Absolute, and that Absolute has become three. One, a cosmos, and many individuals. And somehow at some point, this mistake of being a cosmos and the individuals will get erased, and it's like a middle sort of point, and we'll go back to, or there will be again only the one. So this is these are the two possibilities that arise out of our practical experience, as he's saying over here. And then we rationalize that in terms of, you know, what is the enjoyment then? It can't be the enjoyment. We can't have any knowledge of the enjoyment of the one. because the one can only enjoy the one itself. Otherwise, as he's saying, then there's the cosmos, and the cosmos is different. God, individual, and cosmos must be three different actualities. Otherwise, there could be no relations between them. And these are the two possibilities. Either they are eternally different, in other words, radically separate realities, or they are different in present time. Although they may have originally been one undifferentiated existence and may eventually re-become one undifferentiated existence. So this is it. It's somehow accidentally this triplicity has emerged, and somewhere in the future it will disappear so that only the one will exist. See? So this is the basis of what he's saying, the practical mind. Holds as its logic. I am on this supposition able either to take the world as practically real and think and act in it, or reject it as unreality and cease to think and act. This is again, he's boiling it down from that particular idea to two practical positions vis-a-vis the cosmos. How are we to take the world in which we live? One possibility is that the world is real and I think and act in it. And the other possibility is that it is an unreality, only the one, the absolute, is real. There can't be any middle ground between the absolute and the relatives. So the relatives, either that is the reality, then that we come to materialism and pragmatism, or we say that that is an illusion, in which we come to idealism. So these are the two positions that automatically evolve out of this kind of reasoning. And that's why these are the two most prevalent positions, philosophically speaking, characterizing in a sort of archetypical manner the modern West and the modern East. You see the notion of the Occident and the notion of the Orient. However, that's not really the case. And that's why he ends by saying that there is a triple error in this kind of thinking. What are the three errors? One is that of making an unbridgeable gulf between the absolute and the relative. For one, relatives cannot exist except in reference to an absolute. So there cannot be an unbridgeable gulf. If there are relatives, then there are certain kinds of relatives of the absolute. See? So that is one of the errors. You can't make an unbridgeable gulf. The second is making too simple and rigid and extending too far the law of contradictions. And this is related to what we just discussed about the negatives and positives. When we are talking about the infinite, the logic of the finite cannot hold. The law of contradictions belongs to the world of finites. And through the law of the infinite, contradictions become means to complete each other in an eternal succession, in a perennial succession without end. And the third one is in conceiving in terms of time the genesis of things which have their origin and first habitat in the eternal. Again, here is what we were just discussing about a time outside the notion of a finite time with a beginning and an end. Where is this kind of time? The time that is the idea of the time, idea within the timeless, an event which is not in time. So that is, these are the three errors of this kind of practical mind. So, are there any comments, questions, thoughts? If not, we can stop here. I think it's past 9 already. And I wanted to say that, of course, we'll have our next study session, which will be in October. It will be the fourth week of October, possibly. But after that, the second week of November, I will not be here. I will be, in fact, traveling back from India that day. So we will resume after the next next session we will have, but the one in November, first one in November, we won't have. So we just shift that to the second, the fourth week of November, fourth Saturday of November. I also wanted to say that there'll be a time change on the 1st of November. And want to put it up to those who are present, and then we'll also send it out on the true person on the list, those who attend regularly. I am thinking personally it would be good to go back to the 8 a.m. Saturday morning sort of scene after the fourth week of November. And if anybody has problems with that, you could email me. Let's see what is possible. I think for now, of course, next time we'll meet as usual at this time on the fourth week of October. Not sure what the date is.
Sure.
It's the 24th.
Okay, 24th of October.
Yeah, I mean, at least for me personally, the Saturday morning works fine. But if there are others, then we can discuss it and find out if there's a need to change it.
Sure. You could email me or through the True Person site, whatever. I'll also send out a notice.
Okay, so we'll stop now and I'll continue next time. I'll email you I'll upload the recording at some point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. Good night. Thank you, Devashish.
Good night. Bye.